It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at efforts to eliminate racial inequities in Madison and what work still needs to be done. First, it's time for the Week in Washington, when we look at the biggest stories in national politics. It's been an especially busy week for Senate Republicans, who recently decided to delay a vote on the GOP health care law. And there have also been developments from the White House, this time on the international relations front. The administration sent messages on future relations with countries like Syria and India. You can share your thoughts on the future of the GOP health care bill by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Ginger Gibson joins me now to talk about those topics and more. She's a political correspondent at Reuters. Ginger, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So yesterday, Republicans decided to delay the vote on the health care law, which they were planning to vote on before the July 4th holiday. They were getting opposition from their own party, let alone from Democrats. What are some of the biggest reservations?
I think that there's a lot of concern that they don't have the votes to pass it, and that's why we saw the delay. We're hearing different things from different Republicans about why they can't support this legislation. For starters, we see folks like Mike Lee and Ted Cruz from Utah and Texas, respectively, saying the bill just does not go far enough. We heard Rand Paul from Kentucky saying that they need to be repealing Obamacare or the ACA and not just modifying the program as it exists. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we see Republicans like Susan Collins from Maine saying that the bill doesn't do enough to help those who are going to need help, that it needs to take more steps to make sure that we don't have people uninsured, that we don't have people unable to get to medical care if they can. And so it's a bit of a dual response that has left Senate Republicans saying that they just couldn't move forward this weekend.
Let's take a listen to what Mitch McConnell had to say.
Legislation of this complexity almost always takes longer than anybody else would hope. But we're going to press on. We think the status quo is unsustainable for all the obvious reasons we've discussed over and over and over again.
And so, Ginger, what do you think they will do next to try to get more buy-in, more Congress people, more senators on board?
I think we're going to see a lot of tweaks being made to the bill in its current form. We know that Senator McConnell said today that they expect to have a revised version to the CBO, the government agency, the congressional agency that decides how much bills are going to cost by Friday. There's a lot of discussions going on behind the scenes, a lot of efforts to try to reduce some of those concerns, to convince people to sign on. And I think there's going to be a lot of people making a strong push that the best that we can get is not perfect, and that they need lawmakers to sign on to things that aren't perfect if they're going to make any changes at all.
Now, an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll says that just 17% of Americans that were polled approve of the GOP health care bill as it stands. Do you think that other senators are going to sign on or stay signed on if their constituencies are opposed to it?
Yeah, you're right, that those numbers are important. Those are much lower than any polls we saw done of the ACA, of the original health care bill under Obama. It's hard to sign on to an unpopular bill. The big question that I think a lot of Republicans are asking themselves is, what is this going to mean for the lives of people in my district between now and Election Day? Because that's really what sort of motivates people to vote. If they have insurance, are they at risk of losing it? If they don't have insurance, are they going to be able to obtain it? If they have insurance, is the price going to go up or is it going to go down? People are being polled on the bill at this point in a very abstract position. They don't actually know what it's done to them. They don't feel it or see it at this point. And so I think that what they're going to be asking themselves is, what are people going to feel? How is it going to affect their pocketbooks by the time they arrive at Election Day?
President Trump summoned the 52 senators from his own party to the White House to really try to drum up support and solidify support for this health care bill. And yet it's being delayed. And right now they don't have the votes. What does that say about the leverage that President Trump has right now within his own party in Congress?
I think it's at least showing President Trump that passing bills is not as easy as just making a couple phone calls or sending out a tweet that says, pass this. It's much more difficult than that. And he was able to get some success in the Senate by pressing, in the House by pressing lawmakers on the previous vote. But the Senate's much more difficult. You're dealing with people who have a lot more power and who view themselves as having a lot more power. And so they want to be treated as peers, as equals, as partners in getting things done, not as someone to just be squeezed and expected to respond. In fact, that will turn many of them off. Pushing legislation is tricky, and we've got a president who's never done it before. Many times people get their first experience with the legislative process from the executive office in either being a legislator or being a governor, and we see that that is just not any experience that Donald Trump has had before. And as a result, he's learning on the job that it is quite difficult.
And the health care bill has obviously been very front and center, very public, but there's also work going on a little more quietly among congressional leaders to strike a deal to raise the debt ceiling. How much support is that currently getting?
Yeah, we do know. We were told by a Democratic member of leadership last week that there are private conversations going on, bipartisan conversations, to try to raise the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling is important. If we hit it, it loses the ability of the federal government to borrow money to pay for our bills. It would be quite the problem if we hit the debt ceiling. There are a number of Republicans who just want to raise it without question to get it up so that we don't risk that questioning of the full faith and credit of the United States. But there are some Republicans who think that they should use it as leverage, that they should be able to get things, and that they should not have to, just raise it without getting some concessions. It's going to be a real issue if we get through August without having raised it. There's going to be a lot of tension around this issue, and it's something that is going to get tied up in lots of other issues, which is what lawmakers are trying to avoid. Government has to be funded by the end of September. They're going to undoubtedly have a funding fight. Complicate that with the budget process that normally takes place before they can start funding the government is now getting wrapped up in the health care and the tax reform debate. And adding the debt ceiling into that is going to complicate it. A Congress that has not proved that they're particularly inept at chewing gum and walking at the same time, that struggles to get anything done, adding one more piece is going to be quite a difficult task for them to complete.
Ginger, I want to go back to something you said, that some Republicans are wanting to kind of hold out on increasing the debt ceiling in order to leverage some concessions. From whom would they be looking to get those concessions from?
You know, we see two different groups trying to leverage some concessions. We see conservative Republicans, the really sort of Tea Party folks, trying to get their leadership to cut spending where their leadership doesn't want to cut spending, where even they're more anti-spending than even the average Republican. And then there has been some suggestion that Democrats could try to use this to get leverage, that when Republicans were in the minority, they used the debt ceiling as leverage to get concessions, and that now that Democrats are in the minority, they could do the same. Although Democrats tell us they're not particularly interested in going that route, that they spent so much time insisting that the debt ceiling was not something to be used as leverage, that they couldn't turn around now and use it as leverage themselves. However, we did see Senator Schumer saying last week that if Republicans want to increase the deficit, in other words, require more raising of the debt ceiling by cutting taxes for the rich, the Democrats at least would not be helpful in doing that. And while they wouldn't ask for concessions, they also wouldn't provide him any votes in an assisted manner.
And have we heard from the White House what has President Trump said about the need to raise the debt ceiling, where he stands on that?
We haven't heard in this case from President Trump about his views on this raising of the debt ceiling. He has in the past been critical of raising the debt ceiling, suggesting that it was directly related to spending when it exactly isn't. We have heard from the Trump administration. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin has said he would like to see it raised before the August recess, or that the deadline would be in September. We saw OMB Director Mick Mulvaney saying that it needs to be raised. Someone who in the past has been part of that group that was demanding spending cuts now sort of saying, okay, go ahead and raise it. It looks a little bit from the administration like the realities of governing means that they're saying, you know, don't play games, just go ahead and raise it.
Ginger Gibson is with us now to look at the week in Washington. She's a political correspondent at Reuters, and she's recapping the biggest stories in national politics of the week. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about plans to raise the debt ceiling, about the need to increase the debt ceiling? Are you hoping for a bipartisan plan to raise the limit? Why or why not? And what are your thoughts about the GOP health care bill? Are you glad that it's been delayed, or do you think that the Senate Republicans should be pushing forward? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get to your calls after this short break here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're picking up the conversation with Ginger Gibson now. She's a political correspondent at Reuters and is recapping the week's biggest political stories. You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or posting on the Central Time Facebook page. And Ginger, let's talk about the White House and Syria. The White House has said it has evidence that Syria is preparing for another chemical weapons attack and that it will, quote, pay a heavy price for doing so. Is this a surprising approach?
It was a big surprise for a lot of people to see the White House put the statement out preemptively, essentially threatening Syria that if they were to move forward with any type of chemical attack, that they would face retaliation from the United States. There has been such warnings before. We've not seen such sort of bright red lines drawn by the administration, this administration, thus far. What surprised a lot of people is these are often conversations held behind closed doors. So the United States becomes aware that there's some type of activity. They call Russia, they call Syria, they call other sort of allies and say, if you do this, this will be the consequences. It's really hard to draw a red line in public and then not execute on it. And it prompted a lot of criticism from particularly the Russians, who argued that the U.S. had no evidence that this was happening and that they were saying things without proof. It's a very difficult balance to strike because, on the other hand, there's a possibility that by making this threat, they have prevented or scared the Syrians from implementing another chemical attack like the one we saw earlier this year, which killed scores of civilians, women, children. They were really graphic images that went around the world of these awful atrocities committed against these people. So the administration's going to say, we're just trying to stop that from happening again. But it did cause a big uproar in Washington this week.
Well, and Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, credited the White House's statement with stopping a chemical weapons attack. Is it too soon to say that it actually prevented one?
Well, we will never know, I suppose, is the difficult part here. It's very difficult to prove a negative in any venue. And if they stopped it from happening maybe yesterday, and it happens tomorrow, is that still a success? And I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow, but it would appear that it is at least caused some pause in Syria. And the White House will say that that's what they did. We may never know the answer to that, but I do think that we will hear from the White House that this was a preventative measure, and if we go at least a little while without something happening, a successful preventative measure.
There was another aspect of international relations this week. President Trump and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi also met, and it seems to have been a noticeably warm exchange. How would you characterize the meeting?
The meeting was considered warm. We saw lots of sharing of the photo of Modi hugging Trump. They are two interesting characters to have together. Modi's rise to power was described in a lot of the same terms, populist terms, that President Trump's was. And there is an international power balance going on here. Trump has become very critical of China. He has said he felt that they are not doing enough to stop North Korea from developing weapons that could be used to target China or even the mainland U.S., and that sort of being seen as more friendly with India could be perceived as some as a jab at China, as they are rivals in the region, and that by being so friendly and having such a figurative embrace, not necessarily the literal one, could be a sign that they are they're nudging China a little bit.
Prime Minister Modi focused on issues that we know that President Trump is very interested in and cares about, like U.S. exports and job creation. Does it look like India and the U.S. are likely to strike up more and better trade deals?
It'll be seen yet if they have more and better trade deals, but I think that it has quickly become sort of the preparation of any leader coming to the United States knows to try to find something that they can talk about that is made in the United States and bought in their country, and the ability to have good trade deals. These are two things Trump highly values and likes talking about and likes going out and talking about in front of cameras. So if you're a foreign leader and you can come to the U.S. and say, we love to buy your tractors or your planes or your other items that are made here, that is beneficial to your relationships with Donald Trump.
There were also some tougher issues that exist between India and the U.S. For instance, President Trump questioned India's role and commitment in the Paris Climate Accords. He's also put some restrictions on the H-1B visa program, which many Indians have used to enter the U.S. Do you know that any of those tougher issues were covered in this very friendly and warm meeting?
We do understand that they did talk about immigration and some other issues. You touched exactly on one that is a difficult one. The H-1B visas are largely used by immigrants, workers coming to the U.S. from India. We know that companies, Indian companies that obtain these visas and bring employees to the U.S. to work, particularly in things like call centers and IT functions, continue to be a large swath of that, and of which Trump has wanted to dial back on. It is an issue that Trump has struggled with when he talks about low-wage immigrants, particularly those that are undocumented. He has a pretty clear-cut position on, but it becomes more difficult when he talks about the educated people who work in IT and people who are coming here legally. He's insisted that he's not interested in attacking just all legal immigration, but we do know that he's cutting those back, and that's a place where he's had some divisions with international groups and with the business community, because it would be a reduction in folks who do have degrees and have been coming here to do work. That debatably, they could or could not find Americans to do the same.
We're talking with Ginger Gibson from Reuters, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones and Byron in Wausau. Hi, Byron.
Hello.
What are you thinking?
Well, there's one issue related to the Affordable Care Act and the medical debates that are going on that hasn't received much attention, and I'm afraid it's going to get lost in the Republican bill if they get one passed. That's a 20% limit on the administrative costs that insurance companies can charge. Up to many years ago, Surgeon General Koop and his staff did an analysis of administrative costs for insurance, American insurance companies, and they were anywhere from 25 to 35% or more of the premium money that they took in. No other country in the world spends more than 10% on administrative costs. And interestingly, the Medicare program that we have in the United States, where they bid out on administration, it's actually administered by companies, it's not by the government, but it's on a competitive bid basis. And on a competitive bid basis, the administrative costs are less than 10%.
All right, Byron, let's have Ginger Gibson respond to that. So of all the different moving parts in these health care bills that are floating around and looking for support, is the administrative costs that insurance companies can charge part of the discussion?
Yeah, we have heard that discussed, although it's complicated. Administrative costs are something that Republicans often point to as part of the problem behind the cost of health care, that when people say that health care has gotten too expensive, well, they say, well, it's all this overhead, this unnecessary overhead, particularly when they're talking about government programs. But you're right, the Affordable Care Act in its initial version was able to limit the amount of administrative costs. And if you're in an administered program, plan, as I am, you may have had a year in which I did, in which they came back and said, we charged you too much, and our administrative costs were excessive, and so here's a small refund. And that was the thing that started happening under this bill. I have to admit that I'm not exactly caught up on how the new version would affect that ruling, but I suspect that it couldn't change it, and that's because the process that they're using going to change the health care law without needing any Democratic votes in the Senate, a process called reconciliation, they can only change taxes. They can't change regulations. So this is a regulatory issue, a mandate of sorts, and they would not be able to change it in this current process, but they could potentially change it down the road, either through legislation or through the regulatory process.
Thanks for that call, Byron. And Ginger, as we start to wrap up here, let's look at a little lighter story. President Trump's Time magazine cover from 2009, which were posted at his golf clubs. What are the stories there?
We saw the Washington Post come out and say today or this week that Trump had these sort of fake Time magazine covers, that they were not the actual Time magazine covers of him. And if you read them, they describe The Apprentice as being a smashing success. not exactly the terms that we would think of Time magazine to use, but that we would think of President Trump to use, and that they're hanging in his golf clubs. And so there's been a bit of a call for him now to take them down, since they are not actually the cover, and a little bit of, I think, Schadenfreude criticism that he was pushing fake news.
Well, and I have to say, a lot of people use pretty easy graphic design programs to make fake covers. I've seen people, you know, Photoshop themselves onto Wheaties boxes and things like this. Do you think that this is a serious conflict, or is it more just kind of making that point you said about the fake news?
I think that it's the fake news is what's really getting people going about this, especially since it's not a Wheaties box, it's a Time magazine cover. And Trump just loves to talk about himself when he has been on the cover of Time magazine during the campaign. The first time he appeared on the cover of Time magazine, he talked about it every day on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. So it's something he cares a lot about. Are there real consequences here? Probably not. Is it mostly funny that it turns out these covers aren't real? I think that's probably the case.
Ginger, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Ginger Gibson, political correspondent at Reuters. She joined us for a look at the week in Washington, where we recap the biggest stories in politics. Discrimination and racial disparities are a constant in the lives of many people of color. Here in Wisconsin, we incarcerate the highest percentage of black men by population in the entire country, and Wisconsin has been labeled one of the worst states in the nation for black children based on measures including poverty, single-parent households, and math proficiency. Reverend Alexander G. was instrumental in forming the Justified Anger Coalition, which aims to address racial inequities in Madison. He's also the president and founder of Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development and is the pastor of Fountain of Life Church here in Madison. Reverend G., welcome back to Central Time.
Judith, it's great to be back here. Thank you for allowing me to come.
So remind us of the open letter that you wrote to the Madison community several years ago now in December 2013.
I can't believe that that's almost been 4 years, but that came on the heel of a few incidents, being pulled over by the police in front of my church, going to a prayer meeting one Saturday evening, for no violations, no taillights out. And the other part of that was, I had attended a downtown Rotary meeting where I gave an update on some of the statistics that you mentioned, mm-hmm. and I was thanked for not being an angry black man. And I said, but I am. How did you not hear my talk? How could these statistics be real and I not be angry? You should be angry as well. So I think after that point, I just said, I want to tell my story. So I spoke with a friend who introduced me to folks at the Cap Times, and I told my story and experiences because I want Madison to be all that it can be. I just said I wanted to tell my story in my own words as a person who's grown up in this community. That was called Justified Anger. And then a series of events and things have taken place. But that was the nexus, really wanting to tell my story of personal experiences that I actually thought would never happen to me. I never thought that I'd be profiled by police in my own church parking lot. And that was a rude awakening mm-hmm. for me. And it certainly challenged my access, my belief in my access to the American dream.
And I remember that letter really striking a chord with other members of the African-American community, but also members of white Madison who were shocked that this was going on in what they think of as such a liberal and welcoming and progressive community. And so you really got a lot of interest and a lot of people saying, you know, what's the next step? And so how did the Justified Anger Coalition then come out of that?
What came out of that was, first of all, I was just such a novice in all of this because I didn't write that letter or article to start any movement. I just felt this was my way of expressing my feelings and my experiences here in Madison. Certainly those feelings resonated with others, but I realized this was not a task that I could take on myself. And in actuality, even the four or five, six individuals who stood with me as a part of the coalition initially, our organizations is not enough because we were all African Americans. And our premise for Justified Anger and for the Our Madison Plan, its framework, is that we would create an agenda that would be black led, but it would be implemented by the broader community. And so in order for this to really, really work, the coalition's got to be the entire community. We've got to see the need and see our role in helping to eradicate racial disparities.
And so you just referenced the document titled Our Madison Plan that was released just a couple years ago. So what is in the Our Madison Plan and what is the ultimate goal of it?
Sure. That's a great question, Judith. When we found out about the Race to Equity Report, when it was brought to the public's attention, I think there were at least two camps. One camp that was aghast. How could this happen to us? Others were in complete denial. And when you have such a chasm in a belief system, it's difficult to move ahead because people are so busy convincing each other of their views that the issues still lie unattended to. And so what the Our Madison Plan was a snapshot of the black community, because we heard from Race to Equity. We heard from the state of Black Madison. We were hearing from elected officials. We weren't hearing from the community. So I spent time going to each high school and talking with African-American boys, listening to men who were formerly incarcerated, single moms, and asking, what do you think needs to happen to move the dial on racial disparities? So that was the most comprehensive snapshot of the black situation and the black community taken by black people in Madison's history. And at our rollout, I said, now to do all of this, it would take $20 million, at least over the next 2 or 3 years, because we can't control Department of Corrections and Madison Police Department and the university. But the community said, here are the things that would have to move and shift if we're going to see racial disparity change. So our hope was two things, that the community would look at parts of that framework to say, what can we do inside our organizations in terms of hiring, promoting, recruitment, retention, communication, training? What can we do to move that? And the other piece was to motivate people to get individuals on an individual level to become involved in somehow making that move. And we also wanted to find what are the leveraging points to make the community believe that we can make a difference. Well, when you see a framework and you state that there's a problem, people think you can actually fix it. This is age old and multi-agency and organizational. There's no way that one organization can fix it. But we wanted to identify it so that people could believe that there were problems, because without acknowledging that, no one would agree to work together on addressing them.
Reverend G, I want to go back to something that you said, because you said that when the Our Madison Plan was released, there some people were aghast and shocked and horrified. Some people were in complete denial. But I'm guessing that there was a third group, and that's members of the African American community, for whom
surprised.
It wasn't surprising
exactly.
at all. And so it really seems like that the response to that plan really kind of typifies what the situation has been and what the problem
oh,
is.
Oh, definitely. Because the initial response in the African American community actually was twofold, Judith. One was, duh, we knew. The other part was, why didn't you say anything when Urban League put out a similar report in 2008, 2009 called State of Black Madison? Some could argue with the advent of social media, the Race to Equity just caught traction. But there was very little response when some of the same information was stated by a black consortium in 2008, 2009. So the black community was really vacillating between those two opinions. We know it's happened, but we've been trying to tell you for years. In fact, my nonprofit, Nehemiah, is 25 years old. We created it in 92 because of racial disparities. So there are people who are still thinking, either this is made up or it's a new reality, when in fact we were actually late getting to the game of addressing racial disparities in 92 when I created my nonprofit to empower Black families because of the lack of representation in many of our mm-hmm. systems, you know, schools, mm-hmm. judges, social workers.
We're talking with Reverend Alex G. about the Justified Anger Coalition, our Madison plan, and what challenges are still facing the African-American community in Madison, in Wisconsin, and beyond. And Reverend G., our Madison plan focused on several main areas: education, economic development, mass incarceration, family and community wellness, and leadership development. And what do you think of those has seen the most progress in the years since it started?
You know, it's interesting. There's so much work that has to take place, Judith, when you're trying to move race relations. Our knee-jerk reaction is a technical solution. More diversity, more hires, we'll fix this. When really it's a complex adaptive issue. It's a complex adaptive system. So how do you affect the thought patterns, experiences, hunger, truancy, homelessness, lack of role models, lack of training? There's so many moving pieces that to try to harness all of that to move in the same direction is very, very difficult. So we decided not to rank those five areas because we said they are interrelated. Mm-hmm. But the community identified those areas. It wasn't the think tank at campus. It wasn't a bunch of nonprofit leaders. We listened to the community. And so any traction in one would be attraction in so many of them. So because we really want to mobilize Madison for change, we decided to bring together the team members or the stakeholders. Let's just use education, for example, mm-hmm. from Edgewood, Madison College, UW-Madison, and then most of the organizations from One City to Boys and Girls Club, Urban League, Nehemiah, Odyssey, Omega, the organizations that serve Black youth educationally, coming together and work on a single goal that together, collaboratively, they would bring individual and organizational strength to not only move towards addressing that issue, but de-siloing these 12 agencies that rarely do anything mm-hmm. together. With criminal justice, we have someone from the federal prosecutor's office, the state public defender, the DA, we have a judge, we have the sheriff. These groups have never really agreed to work together for a year minimally to find a common goal that we can work on together to move the needle on criminal justice or mass incarceration. So actually de-siloing some of the service providers is how we address these issues, because that siloing makes it very difficult for African Americans to receive the services and support that we need. And so on one hand, the plan says we've got to empower African Americans, but on the other hand, we've got to really challenge and tweak the systems and the stakeholders so that we play and work together in the sandbox. Because if folks are ready for change and the organizations aren't collaborative in how they provide those changes, then we're defeated. And so trying to make sure that there's unity so that direction for this comes from those stakeholders down. But at the same time, the grassroots folks are saying, here are some of the quick wins we can have. This is what we need: more after school programs or alternatives to incarceration. So having information come out of those work groups around those five areas you mentioned, education and leadership, but also information coming from the ground up, helps us to have the top down, bottom up idea process or dream process, so that our results are not just about programs, but how do you move systems and people's hearts being changed to want to engage these issues on a personal level rather than just watching the Black community do this for themselves.
We're talking with Reverend Alexander G. He was the driving force behind the Justified Anger Coalition. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're African American, what challenges have you faced living in Wisconsin? What changes do you think would make a difference? And where do those solutions need to come from? And if you're not Black but concerned about these issues, where do you see room for progress? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. The Reverend Alex G. stays with us to discuss efforts to eliminate racial disparities in Madison and beyond. And we want to hear from you. What are you thinking on this issue? You can call 800-642-1234. How do you think it's come to be that Wisconsin ranks so badly in terms of how African Americans fare in our state? What would success mean in addressing the many racial gaps we face? And what are you seeing in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Reverend G., I want to ask you about some recent acquittals in high-profile cases of police officers shooting and killing black men. In the span of just 1 month, there were acquittals of police officers in the killings of Philando Castile in Minneapolis, of Sylville Smith in Milwaukee, and of Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa. What impact do verdicts like that have on the African-American community?
It has a tremendous impact on morale. There are days I wake up, Judith, and ask myself, what year is this? My undergraduate degree is in African-American history, and there are days I wake up and feel like I'm back in one of my textbooks. And so I think we felt, many of us feel, well, if there's video evidence, it'll be easier to prove this, to indict someone. And even today, you know, the case of Laquan McDonald and how it's coming to light that police officers were complicit in hiding some of the material. It's disheartening because it reminds African-Americans of the history, the uneasy history that we've had with law enforcement. So it just regurgitates those old feelings. When I was a kid, my grandmother talked about Emmett Till. And now we're talking about new names like Philando Castile and Michael Brown. And so I just feel that we take steps forward and we take so many steps backwards. And I have a brother who's in law enforcement. He's a police officer in a major community. I appreciate what he does. I love law enforcement. But I just feel that in this day and time, to have a sense of fear or angst for my daughter if she's stopped, or for me if I'm stopped, just having the sense that I'm not sure if I can survive it, not just avoiding a loss of points, but just surviving it is I don't even have the words to explain how daunting and how ominous that is.
Well, and I think something that many white parents are not aware of is that African-American parents feel the need, especially with their sons, to give them the talk.
Oh, yes.
and tell them how to try to stay safe. Can you give us a little insight into what that talk entails?
I mean, it breaks my heart. I've had to give my daughter the talk. I mean, I was taught to keep my hands attended to, not to get out of the car, not to make sudden movements. But I learned to drive 40 years ago. And so there wasn't this sense of fear. But my daughter's a 20-year-old co-ed. She's a senior at UW-Madison. Good driving record. But I've instructed her. And this breaks my heart to do so, because I know by saying this, I do put her at risk. If it's a dark street, put your hazards on, call 911, you know, let them know that you're being pulled over, but you're trying to move to a well, you know, well-lit area. Don't drive fast. Don't flee. Keep your hands at 10 and 2. Because I know that my daughter would freak out if she were pulled over by the police. She'd start crying. She'd start shaking. It would be easy to think she's drinking or on something if she were asked to stop. You know, she cries in the back seat if I get a ticket. So I fear what her physical and visceral reaction would be to a stop, and what that means. And for the reaction, it overwhelms me. There are very few things that worry me more than that. And I don't like having that, because her uncle is a police officer. But I actually have more talks about that than date drugs. I mean, I just may say, when you go to a party, you know, have your friends hold your cup. Don't leave it. Don't put anything down. But in terms of, like, specifically what you do if you're stopped, I just go into great detail. And I hate that I've got to do that, because I don't want her to grow up in a world where she needs to understand that she's got to take precautions that her white friends don't have to. And it's sad.
We are talking with the Reverend Alex G., and we have some callers who would like to join the conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And let's go to Jerry in Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. I'm calling in response to your question. That is, I'm an African-American male, obviously, and I have had the fortune to travel throughout the world, throughout the United States, and without question, by far, Wisconsin is worse. It's, and I say it because many reasons, but by, and we're focusing on the police, and that's, although that's a very serious problem, it's more than that. You know, it's the people. You know, I've had people, I've had conversations with people who are in their 20s and 30s, and in Milwaukee, and say, you know, I've never had a conversation with a black person. And you know, and it's not just the conservatives, it's the so-called progressives as well, and progressives I find worse. Because progressives know, you know, how to voice their opinions and say the correct things, but they're just as bad or worse than the conservatives. So, you know, cause I can understand the conservatives, because I know how they think. And so, you know, for instance, this program, it should be, you should be having white people call to express their feelings.
I'm going to ask you to stop there, Jerry, just because I want to make sure Reverend G has a chance to respond. And it seems like there are those, like you said, the silos among different organizations, but also silos between different communities.
Sure. I think the issue with Wisconsin is we want to believe that we're a post-racial society. So that's why many Wisconsinites, African-American Wisconsinites, would say it's easier to navigate in the South because you know where to go, what to say, and how to maneuver. Whereas in this area, you're not sure, everyone seems nice, and then you hear these weird comments way out of left field. But I think it really grows out of a sense that we have not kept up with the growing diversity of the community, and that when we said we need more teachers, social workers of color, the response was, we love everyone, we don't see color. And I just think we've created this vacuum of being outnumbered. And so people do live in a community like ours and not have an interaction with an African American until college. And I think part of it just comes out of an overestimation of our niceness and our ability to relate to everyone. So we didn't think that it was important to be culturally competent or to bring people of color into key positions. And that's part of, this is part of what we're left with.
Thanks for that call, Jerry. And let's go to Jeff in Madison next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Just a quick question. Why the name Justified Anger? Wouldn't it be better to have something more positive, like Unified Action or Unified Justice or something just more positive?
All right. Thanks for that call, Jeff. And actually, Reverend G, I know you wanted to address that.
Sure. I would say I appreciate Jeff's question, but Jeff has the luxury of having not grown up being angry. And so those words that he mentioned, they don't resonate with me. When you think about the issues, I'm an African-American man. I live in Fitchburg. I have an earned doctorate degree. I have a home that I've built. I run a successful ministry. When I was pulled over by the police, in front of my church, I felt disconnected from the American dream. I didn't just feel pulled over. Everything that I believed about my actions have helped me to rise above that because my mom promised me, my teachers promised me, if you do this, get a degree, get a graduate degree, you will not be seen or based or judged by your color. When that all crumbled for me, anger was a natural result. It pulled me out of my bubble of thinking I was better than or I wouldn't be seen the same. And it moved me towards speaking out on the issues. And so I think we have to really rethink the word anger. I'm not, you know, there's an image of when a black man is angry that he's going to start burning down things. I haven't burned down a thing. I build up a lot. But anger has moved me out of my comfort to realize I will no longer stay silent. I will risk my reputation, my name, and resources to move this ahead because I am Madison at its best and its worst. I am Madison in that my mom came here as a single mother on welfare, got a degree, raised me, and sent me to college. But I'm also Madison's worst, where I'm frustrated, where I realize those opportunities, those attitudes are still not prevalent. And I'm a gift to this community by helping to call it back to its purpose. And if I water down the name, I water down the issue. And if people can't respond to anger because of the word, they're not bent on following anyway. We really are about solutions. So let's not get stuck on the name. I'm angry. Point, you know, period. I'm angry because of 400 years of history, but I'm motivated to do something because of that. My anger motivates me. And when I was just suburban, I was comfortable.
Reverend G, thanks so much for joining us today. Reverend Alex G was one of the founders of the Justified Anger Coalition. He joined us to talk about racial disparities in Madison and beyond. Thank you. lot of traffic stops are pretty routine, but Deputy Mike Vi of the Dakota County Sheriff's Department in Minnesota had an unusual one recently. I called Deputy Vi to ask him about it.
I made a traffic stop for a completely different reason, and he just happened to be a passenger in the back seat with no seatbelt on.
And so you check his ID, and it turns out he has warrants.
Yeah, he had a warrant out of Ramsey County for drugs. I had him step out of the vehicle. I brought him back to my squad and told him about the warrant, placed him under arrest. He had a smirk on his face and said there was something in his pocket I needed to see. I didn't know where this was about to go, but he took out a Monopoly get-out-of-jail-free card and began to laugh uncontrollably.
So he was just carrying around this get-out-of-jail-free card.
Yeah, I asked him, like, how long have you been carrying this for? And he told me, like, I knew I had the warrant, so I've been carrying around just in case.
And did that carry any weight?
I had to check a couple statutes, but we don't go by the Milton Bradley rules at the sheriff's office. So, unfortunately, he is sitting and waiting on a court date.
That was Deputy Mike Vi of the Dakota County Sheriff's Department in Minnesota sharing the story of a recent and unusual traffic stop. Coming up, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about the latest Marquette Law School poll results. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.